Our second case this morning is case number 59823, Nielsen versus District Court, Branch Banking and Trust Company. Mr. Oakes for the petitioner, Mr. Sylvester for the real parties in interest.
May I proceed?
Yes, Mr. Oakes.
Good morning. Michael Oakes representing the petitioners of the law firm Foley and Oakes. May it please the court. I'd like to speak, it's been discussed already, but I think it's necessary to take a little bit broader look at the legislature's intent. It was described in their amicus brief, and I think it's worthwhile to read from that brief just briefly. The legislature enacted the new statute in response to Nevada's ongoing foreclosure crisis and the severe, persistent, and continuing obstacles it imposes to Nevada's economic recovery. There's additional language in their introduction section, but I think when you hear that, there is no doubt. It is the legislature's intent that this statute, the new statute, apply to this crisis that Nevadans are facing right now. It has nothing to do with attempting to alleviate some crisis in the future. This crisis that is being faced right now is unprecedented. It's the biggest economic disaster in Nevada's history, and it is within that backdrop that the legislature enacted this statute. There have been efforts to pick apart the legislature's intent in an effort to reduce the effect of the statute. The argument was made that it relates solely to post-foreclosure assignments. We certainly argued that there was nothing in the language itself to support that conclusion. The legislature in their amicus brief completely agreed with our position and stated that it applies to all successor creditors. The second thing comes up in relation to the effective date of the statute. Again, we've been arguing based upon the change when the bill went before the Senate, and based upon the language contained in the legislature's digest, that there is no doubt that the intent was that this would apply to existing cases and would impact any deficiency judgment awarded on or after the effective date. As explained in the amicus brief, the Legislative Council Bureau felt that it was accomplishing that based upon its understanding of this court's prior ruling in the Holloway case. I would note in Holloway, as in some of the other cases, in each of the other cases cited by Mr. Polsenberg, that in each of those instances, the court was faced with a situation where there was no indication whatsoever about the effective date and the applicability of that statute to the presently existing cases. That is vastly different from what we're facing here. You have a strong overall public policy of a need to address the situation that is here today. You have B, the legislative digest, and you have C, the fact that the effective date was changed. All of those factors point to the only conclusion, which is absolutely, as stated in the legislature's amicus brief, there is an intent that this apply to existing cases. I want to hit briefly on intent in connection with NRS 40.451. There's been a discussion of the interim capital case where Judge Dawson held that the words such amount in the last sentence of 40.451 refer back only to the last segment of the preceding sentence. And based thereon, he concluded that there is no consideration limitation contained in 40.451. Our legislature rejected that last session. It came up in connection with an attempt to amend 40.451 so that it would read absolutely consistent with the interpretation of the interim capital case. The legislature rejected that attempt, and it did so. We have the record before you. The changes were shown as proposed amendment number 181 to Senate Bill 402, and those changes were deleted by amendment number 740 to Senate Bill 402. So in connection with 40.451, which, by the way, does not have any of these concerns relative to vested, not vested, retroactive, prospective, in connection with that, under the case of PEBP versus Metropolitan Police, we have language that supports the conclusion that, indeed, there is a consideration limitation in that last sentence of 40.451. In PEBP, the court relied upon some rules of statutory construction and adopted in a footnote the language stating that while subsequent legislation clarifying a statute is not necessarily controlling, it is strongly indicative of the legislature's original intent. Also, an amendment which, in effect, construes and clarifies a prior statute will be accepted as a legislative direction declaration of the original act. We think that those comments apply to the correct application of 40.451. It does contain a consideration limitation, and it always has. By refusing to modify it, the legislature is telling us, yes, there is a consideration limitation, and we're not willing to eliminate it. In addition, since they enacted the change and added 4591C, we also know that they clearly want a consideration limitation. We think those factors justify upholding the applicability of 40.451 to this case. I want to talk then about constitutionality and police powers. And again, it only applies to the new statute, the AB 273 portion. No one's talked yet about the Kmart case. In Kmart versus SIIS, the court stated, this is a vested right, and this statute is being applied retroactively. And then it held, that's a proper exercise of the police power. And that was based merely upon the reduced spending power due to inflation of the pensioners that were going to be affected by the legislation. If police power is properly exercised in that circumstance, how can it not be proper here? I don't need to go into too much hyperbole, but it's no mystery that this is the worst economic situation our state has ever faced. Period. Bar none. This is absolutely a proper time and a proper place and a proper subject for the exercise of the state's police power. Even if you find that it is affecting vested rights and is therefore a retroactive statute. So, I've started with that. Let me go back. There's another point to say. I don't concede that it's retroactive, and I don't concede that there are any vested rights being affected. There is no magical point in time, short of entry of judgment, where things change so much that they should be viewed as, okay, now they're vested. Clearly from Holloway, we know that we're not saying it's a vested right when you sign a note and deed of trust. So I would suggest it would be improper to arbitrarily pick some event along the way and say, now it's vested. I would say clearly if someone has a judgment, it's vested then. But to pick some arbitrary date along the way of saying, well, when does it vest? Notice of breach, foreclosure sale date.
The foreclosure sale in this case occurred in May of 2010, correct?
It was, I don't have the exact date, Your Honor. It was certainly prior to the effective date.
A full year prior, correct?
Yes. So my point being, at what point in time would you say it vested? Is there something magical that happens on the foreclosure sale date that would be the point in time where now it's vested? Well, what if they lose? What if the fair market value doesn't justify it? There's all kinds of things that would still have to happen before they show their entitlement to a deficiency judgment. I think, frankly, the court should avoid any picking and choosing of arbitrary dates in an effort to say, here's where it's vested. And I don't think you need to reach that because we have the Kmart case that says even if it is vested, the legislature nonetheless had the power to do what it did under the state's police powers.
why isn't the foreclosure date the appropriate date around which a vested right would be determined? We establish the basis for the deficiency connected with that sale date. Why wouldn't that be the appropriate date? Mr. Polzenberg, in the previous argument, I think, wants to talk about vested rights being established at the point where the contract has been entered into, but at least in the context of determining a deficiency judgment, why wouldn't the foreclosure sale date be the appropriate date?
Because I think it's, with all due respect, somewhat arbitrary. Nothing magical happens on that date as far as the expectations of the parties. The expectations of the parties are no different than they were from the very time when the contract was signed.
But it's the date that defines whether there's a deficiency or not.
That is the date when you do the fair market value valuation, and you tie to that, absolutely. But again, even if you were to say that that's the date when it becomes vested, I would still rely upon the Kmart case stating that even if it's vested, even if the statute is retroactive, that nonetheless the legislature properly exercised its police powers in enacting this legislation and affecting those types of cases. I see that my time is
you have 4 minutes and 15 seconds left.
So I think I'll leave it here and save the rest for a rebuttal.
All right, Mr. Oaks, thank you. Mr. Sylvester, on behalf of the Real Party in Interest.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. Jeffrey Sylvester on behalf of Branch Banking and Trust, the successor by acquisition to the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. This case is wholly inappropriate for a writ of mandamus because before this Court is no evidence that there's been a manifest abuse of discretion. None. There must be an apparent absence of grounds or reason upon which the decision was based in order to grant a writ of mandamus. The only issues before this Court are whether or not 4451 is to be interpreted as the petitioner suggests and whether or not 40.4591C applies to guarantors or whether or not it is in fact retroactive. Before this Court, however, are not the issues of federal preemption, the Contracts Clause violation, or whether or not, in fact, the legislature intended 40.4591C to apply to commercial borrowers and guarantors. The answer is they did not. Because they have not addressed those elements and those bases which can support the district court, writ of mandamus is inappropriate. The primary argument is that 40.451.
Before you move on, counsel, there doesn't seem to be any distinction in the language of the statute itself between commercial transactions and residential transactions, is there?
I believe that there is. If you look at the two things that occurred in connection with AB 273 was the enactment of 40.4591C, and at the same time there was the enactment of 40.495. When the bills were introduced, Mr. Conklin stated 40.459C applies to protect homeowners. And his statements in the conference were that this applies to a situation, this bill applies to a situation where a homeowner who purchased the property or the home, never treated it as an investment, loses the property, is ousted from the property, and then there's a deficiency judgment.
Well, counsel, I've read the whole legislative history, and I don't necessarily disagree that the focus of the legislature was dealing with residential loans. But my question was the language doesn't seem to make that distinction. And there's been a lot of conversation here about what Mr. Conklin or his committees or the LCB meant or didn't mean. But focusing on the plain language of the statute, is there a distinction?
There is.
Okay.
And to answer your question, Justice Hardesty, and again, we were talking about the 273 addressing two aspects. At the same time 40.459 was passed, Senator Conklin introduced and the legislature passed 40.495. 40.495 in its introduction was stated to apply to the commercial lending situation. 40.459 is a fully self-contained statutory provision relating uniquely to commercial guarantors. The statute itself provides that the mechanism by which a lender may request and receive a waiver of the one-action rule and therefore commence an action directly. It also includes, within the statutory scheme, the complete calculus to determine the damages following a foreclosure sale against a guarantor. Notably, while the amended 40.4591C to arguably take into consideration the consideration paid for the assignment, there is a complete absence of that limitation with respect to the calculus that the courts are to use in determining damages against a guarantor. If you look at 40.4954A and B, it tells you precisely what the differential is. It is, again, the difference between the fair market value and the amount of the indebtedness, whichever is greater. That's the way it has always been since Shields made it apply to guarantors. There is nothing in the context of 40.495 that would apply that to, 40.459 that would apply that calculus to guarantors, and there's nothing in 40.495 that limits the amount of the consideration. That interpretation is entirely consistent with how the bills were introduced by Mr. Conklin. Mr. Conklin said 40.459 is to protect those homeowners who lost their home and now face a deficiency judgment to stop that profiteering by the collection companies. There's no application with respect to actions against guarantors. It just simply isn't part of the analysis. And when Mr. Conklin introduced the bill, he says this section applies in the commercial lending setting. The difference is that 40.495 applies to all actions commenced after the effective date, which was the June of 2011. The petitioners would have you believe that the legislature intended that to be a fully self-contained statute, but to only to apply to actions commenced after the effective date. But somehow, the ambiguity of 40.4591C applies to those lucky guarantors where the bank foreclosed and commenced an action, because they will concede that to the extent there is an action that is commenced against a guarantor after the effective date, 40.4591C has no application. They cannot limit the amount of a judgment against a guarantor by the consideration paid. It's just simply not part of the calculus in this fully contained statutory scheme. 40.495 includes, as an addition, a change in the title where it provides for a limitation on amount of judgment. That is the same language that applies in 40.4591C. Same statutory heading, if you will, to that statutory provision, such that if it's not a guarantor, you're going to look at 40.4591C. If it is a guarantor, you're going to look at 40.495. Going back to 40.451, the interim capital decision and Judge Dawson's opinion is on all fours, and it's a very well-reasoned position. I think it is fair to question the petitioner's logic to attempt to equate the lien with the indebtedness when, as Judge Dawson indicated, there's no real plausible connection between those two. Additionally, to suggest that 45.1 has always been that way, a limitation on that of consideration paid, would render the language in 40.4591C superfluous. You would basically have 40.451 that limits the indebtedness by the consideration, and then you have it again in 40.4591C, limiting the consideration. We don't interpret statutes to be superfluous, which means, as Bill Fossey has suggested, 40.451 was never intended to limit the amount of the indebtedness by the consideration paid to acquire the note. It would also abrogate common law in as much as it would limit the rights of an assignee to the full payment and the same rights of the assignor. And, of course, it would lead to the absurd results that Judge Dawson has indicated would exist to the extent that you limited the amount of the indebtedness to the consideration paid. Judge Dawson gave us a couple of examples. I can recite those or reiterate those, but it's fairly clear that it would relate and result in absolutely absurd results. Additionally, 40.451, if interpreted as the petitioner suggests, would result in a windfall and an unjust result. The entire statutory scheme for the deficiency statutes is to avoid the unfair and unjust results. That's what Shield said. That's what all the cases in Shield have said. But to accept that interpretation and not just limit it to 40.451, but to 40.4591C, it would relate or result in an absurd result. Shields tells us that the purpose is to prevent double recovery, but it is not to deprive the lender of full repayment. In fact, the scheme itself allows for the mechanism by which the lender can be made whole. if you interpret it the way they have suggested, every time there's an assignment for less than the full amount of the indebtedness, it will effectuate a release of the guarantor and the borrower. That is a fundamental change to the underlying obligation. That is not what Holloway said. Holloway was a contracts clause case, and Holloway said, we can apply this case, or this new rule, without violating the contracts clause, because the mortgagee is going to receive all that which it is entitled to receive, because constitutionally they're entitled to no more. This is different. If you accept the interpretation of both 40.451 and 40.4591C, you are changing the fundamental rights of recovery and the underlying obligation of the borrowers and guarantors. There's no longer going to be a full repayment because it's going to be limited to the consideration paid. To address Justice Pickering's statement, while it is true that they'll be made whole with respect to the amount of consideration they paid for the assignment, that interpretation would abrogate both the Uniform Commercial Code and common law, because you would no longer be entitled to the same rights as the assignor, but something less than that. And if you're getting something less than that, that is a violation of the contract clause. AB 273 is ambiguous. I couldn't have said it any better than Mr. Flansburgh when he eloquently stated, you don't have a right to obtain a judgment until after the foreclosure sale, until after the court makes the analysis that there is a deficiency owing. That's the right that is addressed in 40.4591C. The legislature stated that if you acquire the right to obtain the judgment from somebody who previously held that right, it's limited by the amount of consideration. And so the question then is, when does that right arise? The right arises, as Justice Hardesty suggested, arises at the time the foreclosure sale occurs. Because on that date, you know what the fair market value of the property is, and you know what the indebtedness is. And only after that date and time can you apply for and receive a deficiency judgment. 40.455 says, if the trustee's deed upon sale reflects consideration less than the indebtedness, the court shall award, following a hearing, a deficiency judgment. So when the legislature speaks of the right to obtain the judgment, there is no quarrel that they are referring to the deficiency judgment. Mr. Flansburgh concedes that that right that is the subject of 40.459 doesn't arise until after foreclosure. To suggest that somehow the right is inherent in the note is contrary to what the legislature intended. The Legislative Council Bureau filed an amicus brief, which, to borrow a phrase from Justice O'Connor, in the Roe versus Wade analysis, is on a collision course with itself. They state, in order to avoid the idea of a retroactivity or violation of the contract clause, that there's no right to a deficiency judgment. On the other hand, when they're attempting to argue that the legislature intended it to apply to pre-foreclosure assignments, they say inherent in the receipt of the note is the right to a deficiency judgment. Those two positions can't be true. They collide with one another. And the reality of it is, Congress intended, or the legislature intended, that the right to the deficiency judgment is the right that is to be affected. If we look at the ambiguity that results, and you look at the legislative history, it is clear that what Mr. Conklin was saying is, we want to protect the homeowner from those aggressive credit collection companies. And what we want to do is to compel a conversation between the lender who has foreclosed and the homeowner. Because
so is it your position that 40.4591C only covers post-sale assignments?
That's correct. Post-foreclosure assignments.
So you differ from Mr. Polsenberg's reading of it, that it covers all assignments from...
I didn't hear Mr. Polsenberg say that. Mr. Polsenberg was responding to the rights that were being affected by virtue of the statute. Mr. Polsenberg stated that you have the constitutional right to full repayment. And that's the right that he was referring to in connection with the Holloway.
How do you make your argument work with the plain language of 1C? That the right is one that is only transferred post-sale, and that's all this statute applies to.
That is our argument.
I understand that, but look at the language. When would that right to obtain the judgment previously held be acquired?
It is a
post-sale?
It is a post-foreclosure assignment. That we are, the entire legislative history and the statute itself reflects and relates to post-foreclosure assignments because it speaks of the right to the judgment. The judgment is qualified.
But why would it then calculate the math according to the fair market value of the property? If you acquired it post-sale, presumably you wouldn't be acquiring it with reference to the fair market value of the property at all.
Justice Pickering, that's exactly the point that we made, because you the statute is internally inconsistent. When there has been a transfer of...
But it's internally inconsistent by virtue of the reading you're foisting on it.
It is internally inconsistent by ascribing the plain language of the words utilized by the legislature. When they speak of the right to obtain the judgment, and Mr. Flansburgh has conceded in his argument that the right to obtain the judgment only exists after a foreclosure sale. The interpretation that we have proffered is entirely consistent with what the legislature considered at the time of the passage of AB 273. It was every example that is set forth by Mr. Conklin and in his discourse with Mr. Atkinson related to post-foreclosure assignments. There's not a single example or a single discussion with respect to pre-foreclosure assignments. Those pre-foreclosure assignments would be, to the extent that this court were to find them, that interpretation would be a violation of the Supremacy Clause, would be preempted by federal law. It is crystal clear that what the legislature intended was that this prohibition or this limitation relates solely and exclusively to post-foreclosure assignments. For all the reasons that we have cited, we would ask that this court simply deny the request or the petition for the writ of mandamus.
Thank you, Mr. Schweitzer. Mr. Oakes.
Thank you. Justice Pickering, I think you're absolutely right. There's no language in the statute at all to distinguish between pre- and post-foreclosure sales. Plus, it wouldn't make sense in light of what the legislature was trying to do. They weren't here trying to draw a line against one sort of conduct and not the other. What they were trying to do was provide help to Nevadans who were facing an economic crisis and provide relief to Nevadans from deficiency judgments where the creditor had acquired the rights whenever they acquired them for cents on the dollar and then wanted to sue for the whole face value of the note. Relative to the vesting argument, in Holloway, the court relied on Gelfert, the U.S. Supreme Court case, and the following language was quoted. It says, the formula which a legislature may adopt for determining the amount of a deficiency judgment is not fixed and invariable. That which exists at the date of the execution of the mortgage does not become so embedded in the contract between the parties that it cannot be constitutionally altered. That language seems to me to be making no distinction as to the point in time and also doesn't even seem to be making any distinction as to vested rights or non-vested rights. Therefore, I don't think it's necessary in any reading of Holloway to determine that somehow a determinative factor had to do with the point in time of the foreclosure in that case relative
to... If you were
to,
analyzing the wrong vested rights here, perhaps the vested rights that one should examine are those that occur at the time of the assignment. The legislature's expectation was to cap the recovery. Holloway may very well be perfectly consistent in assuring that they recover what they paid for their assignment.
I would read it that way. I think that when you heard all this argument, first by Mr. Polsenberg and a little bit now with our case, that the distinction is that we're trying to avoid double recovery. Well, the fact of the matter is that the creditor who loaned face value of the note is long gone. They chose to get rid of that note at a significant discount. The creditor then who is coming in to sue for the deficiency is, in fact, going to be paid in full as a result of the statute the way we read it and as the way we think the legislature intended.
Could you address counsel's distinction or suggestion that 1C doesn't apply to commercial loans, apparently, because of the amendments that were made to 495 here.
I think it's absurd. Very clearly, under 40.451, you have a definition of indebtedness that applies to actions under 40.459. 40.459 clearly says in the preamble that this is relative to all actions against a debtor, a guarantor, or a surety. Well, we don't have guarantors and we don't have sureties on residential loans. You might have a guarantor. I've never seen a surety on a residential loan. The point being, 40.459 applies 100% across the board to all deficiency actions. Furthermore, 40.495 specifically states, I think it's subsection 3, that all defenses available under 40.459 are available. So there is no distinction. It absolutely extends to commercial loans. And the last point, I see my time is running. Quick note on preemption. In Jensen, this court found that preemption applied, and it did so in the context of a discrimination case, a type of area that is traditionally the subject, may I finish?
Yes, please.
That is traditionally the subject of federal legislation rather than state legislation. In our case, this is an area traditionally governed by the historic police powers of the respective states. Therefore, unlike Jensen, this case has the presumption against preemption that was not in effect there, and therefore this court should determine that the preemption argument is not applicable here. We thank you for your time and consideration. We hope that you will grant our petition and provide the relief that we've asked for.
The court thanks Mr. Oakes and Mr. Sylvester for their fine arguments in this matter, their briefs, very informative. This matter will stand submitted, and the inbound court will be in recess until 11:30.